Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And lots of thoughts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line about the possibility of the Canucks signing Jake Guentzel. And, of course, the latest report, as we discussed earlier in the show, on that front comes from Frank Saravelli, who's saying that expect the Canucks to make a strong play, in his words, for pending free agent forward Jake Guentzel. Frank also outlines that the Canucks might have the easiest time, at least of some of the teams that are interested in fitting Jake Guentzel under the salary cap. Now, a lot of excitement, but I would say also a fair amount of trepidation over the idea of giving out really, really big money to a guy who will be 30 by the time he plays a game for the team. And this question comes in unsigned, asking simply, what about the defense, though? And whether you're just focusing on the defense or whether you're focusing on depth and everything in general, I think there's this line of thought that, okay, you go sign Jake Guentzel. No one's debating that he's a great player, but, you know, not a big player. As much as he's a playoff performer, he is maybe just very slightly undersized. If that means you're passing and letting Dakota Joshua and Nikita Zadorov walk, how much of the kind of big physical identity are you sacrificing in order to bring in a Jake Guentzel? But my counter to that concern, I don't think it's completely misplaced concern, right? That identity was really, really important for the Canucks. I'm sure Rick Tocchet would love to preserve as much of that identity as he can. But my counter to that is, you know, let's take Zadorov and Joshua, right? Zadorov was acquired for a couple of mid-round picks mid-season from the Calgary Flames. Dakota Joshua was signed as a completely unheralded Group 6 UFA for 2 years at $850,000. So they were able to add that element, which ended up being so beneficial for them, without spending big assets, without spending big on the salary cap to go do it. And I'm not saying it's going to be simple or easy to find guys who can replace what Dakota Joshua and Nikita Zadorov bring. It's not. But can you find enough of what they bring in relatively cost-effective ways to reduce the concerns enough that, you know, the offensive boost from Jake Guentzel vastly outweighs the drop, any drop-off there is from Zadorov and Joshua to their replacements? And I think the answer is yes, you have to have the confidence to do that. Size is important, the physicality, the meanness, all of that is important, but you can't let that stop you from going after the number one free agent on the market, a guy who addresses what was actually your biggest need in the playoffs. You have to have the confidence to go out and try to replace those guys on the cheap because you can get a Jake Guentzel in the door.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we've talked about a fair bit, like in regards to Lindholm, right? Great player, but you have to be able to find penalty killing, size, defensive ability relatively affordably. Like, this is one of the sins of the Jim Benning era, right? Was spending too much on the guys who do a job, you know, and yep. You need the guys who do a job if you're going to win, right? Like, the Canucks had lots of guys who did really good jobs, and it was crucial in driving this dream campaign that everyone in Vancouver enjoyed so much. But if you're paying like the top dollar, what you need to make sure you're paying for is goals and two-way impact, right? And that's where Guentzel has an edge over just about anyone else you could realistically target this offseason. So, you know, I think your point is well made and well taken. And this team's found, you know, go even further back, right? Like Luke Shen.
Yep.
Right? Like, there's all kinds of useful size available on the market. They're not perfect players, right? If they were perfect players with size, then they'd never get to unrestricted free agency, yeah, frankly, right? So,
but you know you what? Know, like, Zadorov and Joshua aren't perfect players either, right? They're good players. They're really good, but really good, really useful
but they're
players.
Awesome.
Yeah, they're awesome, but they're not perfect,
yeah,
right?
Well, and in Joshua's case, too, I do still think there's, despite his age, given just sort of the circuitous path his pro career has taken, largely for reasons outside his control, right? Like the pandemic and taxi squads and weird roster regulations and a split AHL team and all the things that sort of caused him to take longer than normal to make an NHL impact. Like, I think that's, you know, reason to bet that he could even be more than the sort of player you're talking about, right? Like, that's why he sort of stands out to me as like a player worth taking maybe even a bigger risk on from the vantage point of their next contract. But yeah, I mean, you have to be comfortable. You have to be comfortable going into free agency and placing some bets and placing some big bets and maybe even trading to place those bets to sort of find identity guys. You know, the identity guys versus your Gensel type guys, like there's a material difference there. Mm-hmm. And it applies to like the very silly post playoff conversation, especially because of, you know, the gap in the likability of their media availabilities that happened about like Zadorov or Hronek. Right. And it's like, Hronek's a guy you have to pay retail price for.
Yeah.
You know? And Zadorov's a guy I'm comfortable them paying retail price for, provided that it's reasonable enough. But, you know, you don't have to necessarily pay retail price to get players of that ilk, as evidenced, by the way, by the fact that the Canucks have Soucy under contract for 2 more years at $3.5 million. Not that he's nearly as mean as Zadorov, regardless of what the NHL Department of Player Safety said during that Edmonton series. But, you know, same like, some of the same attributes, enough of the same attributes that I do think you can approach Zadorov with an element of caution, you know, even though I'd love to continue to watch and cover that guy.
Yeah. And it'd be one thing. The thing with Zadorov is, and you know, I made the point, look, he's not a perfect player. Joshua isn't. And I think one of the points you're getting at is it would be different if the Canucks already had a Jake Gensel signed, right? And it was okay. Like, hey, we have our skill up at the front of the top six. We can afford to use our cap space on the pure identity guys, like the premium version of an identity big physical defender in Nikita Zadorov. But the nature of a hard cap is you have to make some uncomfortable decisions. So I don't want to say there's no downside to letting Nikita Zadorov and Dakota Joshua walk and using some of that money to sign Jake Gensel. There absolutely is downside. I just think the upside outweighs what you're losing, and those are the types of decisions you have to make, and you have to be willing to make. I mean, we just had the conversation with Randy Moeller, right, about all of the big gutsy swings that Bill Zito has taken as GM of the Florida Panthers, and the team's gone to back-to-back Stanley Cup finals. They're one win away from winning the Stanley Cup as a result. You have to be willing to take those risks, especially when the thing you're betting on is star talent of the likes of Jake Gensel. 650-650 Fish Dancer texts in, what happens if you whiff on Gensel? Ignore all your UFAs and get caught holding the bag. So this would be, hey, you get to July 1st, you haven't signed Joshua or Zadorov, you get a chance to pitch Gensel, he goes somewhere else, and by the time you circle back to the other guys, they're off the market, they've signed somewhere else. Totally fair scenario, totally reasonable scenario, I think, to be worried about going into free agency. That pivots, though, to your latest piece up at The Athletic with Harmon Dial, and of course it is list season at The Athletic, and therefore here on Canucks Talk as well, looking at, yes, Jake Gensel, but some of the other fits out there to help the Canucks in the top six, or really just at forward generally as we go a little farther down the list. And, you know, I know you made the point on the show yesterday about Jonathan Marchessault, and kind of if you were able to lure him away from Vegas being a pretty decent consolation prize for Jake Gensel. What other players do you want to highlight specifically from the list you and Harmon had up at The Athletic today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Marchessault of it all, like, you can tell that I was writing this piece, right?
You had Marchessault on the brain.
I just think, yeah, well, more than anything, I think it's just like, I think Marchessault might be the most underrated elite player in the NHL. You know, I just don't think we're giving him enough credit. He's won a Conn Smythe. He's like one of the league's most consistent 30-goal guys, and yet no one ever puts him in a conversation with a guy like Gensel, ever. And mm-hmm. And I don't think that's quite right. Honestly, I don't. I think he's at that level. Not quite as good, but like in the same tier, right? In the same tier, slightly lower down the list. And that matters, right? Like, that's a very, very high level of player. So more than anything, I wanted to spotlight that when we were talking about it yesterday. You know, more than anything, I just think there's options, right? Like, I just think there's options for a team that's hungry for scoring depth, and that's the Canucks. That could be anyone else too. Marchessault to me is sort of the other elite piece, and then I think you get into like your Toffoli, Teravainen tier of guys, and again, I would say kind of the same tier, but I think Teravainen's probably materially better given his speed and age and his power play impact, and mm-hmm. and that's another thing. Like I was looking at Teravainen one and thinking about it. And thinking, you know, the one problem with Teravainen is kind of been like a third line rate scorer over the last few years. Now, there's some impact from playing Rod Brind'Amour's stress hockey showing up there. But, you know, in Teravainen's case, like what the Canucks really need is someone to help them generate 5-on-5. And this guy's pretty reliant on the power play to be the consistent 50 to 60 point guy that he's been. That said, the Canucks also kind of need a fifth forward for the power play. Yeah. Like they kind of need a fourth forward for the power play. And ideally it's a lefty. I mean, that's one of the reasons to like Gensel so much is you can imagine him fitting in the old Bo Horvat spot, which like make no mistake, right? Make no mistake. I know things went so well for the Canucks this season that no one's done any of that like usual X lurking that Canucks fans often do when guys depart, right? Like even the Oliver Ekman-Larsson might win the Stanley Cup this year after being the largest buyout ever in Vancouver. Like if this team had had a miserable season, how many times do you think we'd have hit that beat over the last month?
It's a good point. And we've barely touched on it.
And likewise, you know, I think that's sort of applied to Horvat in New York, right? Like more likely than anyone is to be like, wow, Horvat, another, you know, 30 goal, 65 plus season with elite two-way impact. Like, man, you know, people are just like, and you guys said they should sign Horvat, which of course that was not our position, but that's okay, right? There's absolutely an argument to be made that Horvat was like a level of contributor on a far inferior New York Islanders team, like the same level of contributor for them that Miller and Pettersson were in Vancouver this year, right? Like he's still very, very good. And while the Canucks power play remained top 10, you know, I do think it's worth noting, right, that like the Islanders were better than 20% on the power play this year. They were 15.8% the year before. Mm-hmm. And Horvat's the only material change to that group. Like, I don't think it's fair to say that the Canucks power play like missed quote unquote Bo Horvat, in that they were still able to put together like dominant months and still finished, you know, 11th overall in the league. And were still good until game 7 of the series against the New York Islanders or the Edmonton Oilers. But I think Horvat was probably a more important 5-on-4 player than we realized. And I don't think the club found a replacement for him, right? We saw so many different guys shift through that. It probably looked best with Kuzmenko, but the rest of Kuzmenko's game was problematic. You know, Lindholm, Garland, like we saw Suter, we saw play there some. We saw Hronek play there. Like the Canucks never really found an answer there. And so I do think that's at least an important enough ancillary need that we shouldn't ignore it in talking about top six forwards. Like if you're able to find a fourth power play one forward who is a left-handed shot, who can complement Besser, you know, you obviously Tocchet's going to want them to switch. And so you've got, you know, different options in the high slot or at the net front. Like Teravainen's a pretty good fit for that. And I think that's worth dwelling on. Like, even if he's not the 5-on-5 threat that Gensel is, even though Gensel, I mean, you saw them both play together in Carolina and Gensel's a materially better player. But Teravainen's still good.
Mm-hmm.
And I do sort of wonder if Teravainen's like in the old Korea Ray Whitney story, like what if Teravainen's the Ray Whitney, especially because I think you can make a bet that maybe, not that the Canucks play a particularly freewheeling system, like I'd rather play this, place this bet as like the Avalanche than the Canucks, but, or the Oilers than the Canucks, but maybe there is more there offensively away from the Carolina Hurricanes environment. I kind of talked myself into him as I was writing through, because my initial response was like, well, he's not a 5-on-5 driver at the level that I think this team needs. But I don't think we should ignore that really, if you're getting a top six star and you're paying big money for them, like I think you want them to be a partial answer to the remaining question mark on PP1.
Oh, you definitely do. You want your big forward acquisition this summer, whoever it is, right? Whether it's Gensel or Teravainen or somebody else, to help you solve that problem. And you know, the point about Teravainen, and okay, you play this defensive system, right? So it's not as if he's coming, as you say, to this run-and-gun offensive team where he's going to necessarily have all these great offensive opportunities to put up bigger numbers than he did in Carolina. But you would be acquiring him to play next to Elias Pettersson, right? And so I think you can allow yourself to dream on an increase of production from that regard, right? That, hey, we're taking this guy who, yeah, maybe doesn't have incredible five-on-five numbers, but he's really smart, skilled, good on the power play, and we're going to plug him next to Elias Pettersson. I mean, we've seen when Pettersson is at the top of his game how he can get really, really good numbers out of guys, right? Like, look at Andrei Kuzmenko, what he did for him in that season, right? I mean, there's been stretches where, you know, Ilya Mikheyev was racking up goals, where, like, Sam Lafferty was scoring. You go down the list, you bring in a higher caliber of player, even if he's not traditionally a five-on-five, a big five-on-five scorer, to go with Elias Pettersson, and I think you could reasonably expect better production from Teravainen at even strength.
Certainly he's never played with a center like Pettersson. I mean, he's played with Aho, who's a killer
really good
driver, but but we've seen Pettersson make a 40 goal scorer of Andrei Kuzmenko, which I don't think he is, and we've seen Pettersson make a 20 plus goal scoring rate guy out of Ilya Mikheyev, which I don't think he is. So, I'm gonna digress here and go on a rant, but this was what always annoyed me about the, like, well, Pettersson doesn't have any line mates. And then people, like, always come back at that with, well, an elite center makes their line mates better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, Ilya Mikheyev scored 11 goals, 12 goals this year. Like, that is making him better. Sam Lafferty scored 13 goals this year. Like, that is making him better. there's not a guy that this dude hasn't played with who hasn't gone off on a career, you know, career season in terms of offensive production. So stop it. Anyway, I talked myself into Teravainen, and Toffoli, I think, is like the low end option of that. You know, right-handed shot, built-in chemistry. I worry a little bit about having both him and Besser in the lineup. Mm-hmm. Like, I just worry a little bit about taking a little too much speed off the table from the Canucks. All told, the Canucks had interest in Toffoli at the deadline, but, you know, we talk about a lot how team speed's like a delicate thing, right? Like, you remove, I don't know, like a couple of speedy options. You remove Joshua, for example, and Toffoli's not as fast. You know, at what point do you begin to be a team that struggles to play the way Rick Tocchet wants his wingers to play, right? Especially on the wing with how this team plays. I think you have to be pretty protective of your speed. I'd still love to see Toffoli in Vancouver, but I do think that's like context worth noting. And then you get into kind of the like DeBrusk. I guess DeBrusk and Toffoli are probably the same tier, right? Complementary,
sure,
like middle six guys more than top line guys, but certainly capable on a second line. And then I think you get into like, you know, Sweat, Gamble tier, right? Your Anthony Mantha, Anthony Duclair, Jason Zucker types that probably, you know, if they're like valuable, if the price is right, certainly if you're slotting them on like the third line, you're not counting on them, then I think you love it. If they're your plan B after you strike out on Gensel, I think that's a totally different matter. I think that's something that you're holding your breath on a little bit more of a hope bet. And then, of course, I included Amadio because I don't know what happened, but Amadio has become my guy. He's become one of my guys. I'm convinced basically that Amadio is the like offensive side of the coin to what Pugh Suter is.
He's definitely, if you're like banking on a Pugh Suter repeat, it's Michael Amadio. 100%. And Amadio,
yeah,
like, I've never done like a deep dive into like his statistical impact or anything, but it's just like every time I watch the Canucks play the Golden Knights, he makes like three plays and I'm like, dang, that was a nice play. That was a good play. You know what I mean? You're like, all right, let's go.
He just accumulates helpful touches, and then he's got like the offensive pop where he's not like getting the chance at the side of the net, where like with Mikheyev, you're like, you know, like Shorthouse no longer goes up. It's like, and a shot. He like no longer even, and it's like, and a chance. And it's subconscious. I'm not like soaring Shorty, but like you can tell. You know, like that's what I'm talking about. And maybe that's just how I feel. Maybe I'm just what's it called, projecting mm-hmm. onto Shorthouse, the experience of watching a Mikheyev scoring chance, where it's like, you know that no matter what the expected goals total is going to be from that shot, the actual expected goal total is zero, right? Expected by whom? So, you know, the Amadio doesn't have that. Amadio can actually score. Like, he's actually got touch, and then he can also play center. You like him better on the wing. He can play, if you need him on your top line, Pugh Suter style, fine. Mm-hmm. If you need him on your second line, fine. You know, the way that this team is like rigorously attacked their floor with just a series of bets, I feel like Amadio's tailor-made for just like roster optionality, for raising the floor of one of three lines, depending on what you need on any given day. Plus, you know, he can play center, right? He really is a center capable of playing wing. And I like that. I especially like that given that, you know, we saw what Miller could do against McDavid defensively, mm-hmm. right? We saw his two-way impact all season long. But, you know, there's going to be games in February where, like, Miller wants to focus a little more on defense and save his bullets for the postseason. Like, that should be okay, right? Like, finding – like, that's why Pugh Suter, I think, is a nice fit there. But having more options, especially if you're going to need to consider using Suter at center on occasion this season – you know, Amadio for me, like, I'm just going to stamp it and just be like, absolutely, the Canucks should go get that guy. He's your best bet at getting the more offensive, less defensive version, the other side of the Pugh Suter coin. It's Michael Amadio this summer for somebody savvy, which means he probably goes unsigned into August.
Yes.
And that would be a tremendous error by
just like
entire
Pugh Suter did. Quickly,
unbelievable.
Before we go to break, because we got a lot of people texting in about it. If you had been making this list next week and Jeff Skinner had been bought out by the Buffalo Sabres, would he have appeared on this list? Because that report is out there from Elliot Friedman that he's hearing it's a possibility.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, a possibility. So, I think yes. I think the short answer is that yes, Jeff Skinner would be on this list. Jeff Skinner, of course, was a Rutherford-era Carolina Hurricanes draft pick, mm-hmm. right? So that's always something worth noting. The savings of a Skinner buyout are enormous for Buffalo this season, right? Like, they save $7.5 million against the cap. So if you're going to do it, this is the offseason to do it. But, you know, the savings do kind of diminish. I guess it comes down to impatience, right? Like, how much does this Buffalo front office need to show progress this year versus how much can they focus on the fact that a $6.5 million cap hit in 3 years is like actually a problem yep. for a team aged the way their team is. I feel like a Skinner buyout is something they'll regret. Like, fundamentally, I think a Skinner buyout is something they'll regret, but something that might happen because of like internal politics and the dynamics of impatience within that hockey market. Skinner would be on my list for sure. Absolutely. Like, what's the argument against it? This guy scores 20 goals a season every single season of his life. Like, he's just a really gifted goal scorer who's probably best used in a second line role or as like a complimentary top line guy. I certainly don't think you should have any illusions that he's as good as like even Teravainen in terms of the act of actually winning games, but he's a good player. And I think he'd be a helpful player, especially if, you know, his next contract was something like 4.5 times 3, right? That, now you're talking. Now I'm really interested. So I like Jeff Skinner a lot.
It has Matt Duchene to Dallas this offseason written all over it, right? Like,
totally.
Veteran, high, really talented player gets bought out, goes to somewhere in a cheaper contract, and thrives.
One plays down the lineup. Like, that's yep. the key. You know, if you can get him down the lineup at a affordable clip, you love it. If you have him at 9,
you don't love it.
Maybe not so much.
You don't love it so much. Okay, we'll take a break. We will check in again on the Stanley Cup final and maybe a little bit of off-season speculation as well with Arda Okal from ESPN. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. This hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free, no-obligation quote. Visit janpro.ca. Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Final tonight in Florida. Joining us now to chat about that and more from ESPN, he is Arda Okal. Arda, thank you for doing this again. How are you?
Jamie Thomas, I'm doing great. Happy to be back on the show in the great city of Vancouver. I lived in Yaletown for a year as a weather guy. Very, very random, but happy to be back on the airwaves.
That is indeed very random. Thank you for letting us know. What was being a weatherman in Vancouver like?
I have a very funny story, actually. So during my training, I was with the Weather Network for a year out in Vancouver before I moved to the States. And part of my onboarding, they showed me that famous clip of you guys remember the Roberto Luongo doing the weather report. So they showed me that clip. For those unaware, I'm sure everyone in Vancouver knows it, but basically the reporter went to one of the parks, did a streeter, what we call basically like talking to people about the weather. And instead of like they found Roberto Luongo and didn't talk to him as Roberto Luongo, they talked to him as just Roberto in Vancouver, or Rob. It might as well have been Rob in Vancouver. So he has this, it's this clip of him just talking about the weather. No name, key, nothing. Just random dude on the street. And so they show me this clip. And after it ends, it's an executive. He looks at me and goes, "Don't do that. We will fire you." And I'm like, thank goodness I'm a hockey fan. I know what I'm – I can spot Roberto Luongo. I think I'll be all right.
But see, that clip got them lots of attention. They should have been thrilled. The all-timer, though, was Jerome Iginla in the Boston snowstorm, where they are talking to him. He's like, yeah, 100%. He's like, I'm from Canada, so it's not that big a deal.
Those are so good. It's so. Didn't Kyle Davidson have one similar to
that? Yes, before like, the draft the record, last year, I believe. Yeah, where it was just like, hey, you excited for the draft? He was like, I sure am. I'm going to take Connor Bedard. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I'll be a little busy. Yeah, exactly.
Let me tell you how excited I am. Okay, so as I mentioned, Game 5 of the Cup Final tonight. And, you know, we've talked a lot over the last couple of days about how will the Panthers respond after that beatdown on Saturday. How will the Edmonton Oilers respond, you know, with their backs still up against the wall? What are you most curious about going into this one tonight?
The first 10 minutes of the game. I think that whichever team – I'm curious to see which team comes out of the gates hotter. Will it be both, and we're going to see a track meet for the first period? Are we going to see what we saw from Edmonton, where they just, like, stormed out of the gates last game? They scored a shorthanded goal. Panthers clawed one back, but then they just didn't look back, did the Oilers – and ran away with it. Are we going to see the Panthers rejuvenated now that they're home and they have that loud building in their favor this time? And now they, like, there's so many great questions going into this particular game. Like, the Panthers have been in this situation before. They don't want this to slip away, and they know how important this game is. And we all feel it, too. It's almost like the narrative is either the Panthers close it out emphatically at home in this game, but if the Oilers win this particular game, you ask most hockey fans, and let me throw it back to you guys. Like, if they win this game, it feels like it's going 7. Like, it feels like they're not going to lose at home again.
Yeah.
That's at least a hunch from a hockey fan watching this. That's how it feels going into this game.
Yeah, I think that's a good hunch. It's one I kind of agree with, especially because, you know, for all that the Florida Panthers lead in this series, one thing I've sort of kept repeating throughout the show is I don't think the Panthers have been, you know, 3-1 lead better than the Edmonton Oilers have, in fact, throughout this series.
Yeah. I mean, they were just too little too late, especially in game 3, that they could have tied that game if they had turned it on sooner. And I do, there is credence to the idea that Chris Knobloch and company are saying, look, we have had our chances. We have had our moments. We just haven't found the back of the net. We haven't gotten the bounces. Sergei Bobrovsky was great other than game 4. So I can buy that for sure. The thing is, though, is that the Oilers, like, there's no room for error. The Oilers will have to be perfect. Stuart Skinner has to be awesome. Connor McDavid has to be McJesus. Leon Draisaitl has to show up. The other top 5 scorers that up until game four didn't score a goal in the series, they got to show up and show out. They got to continue getting that depth that they did from the likes of the Warren Fogles and the Adam Henriques and the Dylan Holloways of the world. So that absolutely has to continue. There's no room for error. There is no margin. There is nothing. There is only, we have to play perfect 60 minutes, 200-foot hockey for the rest of the way. And the question is, do you believe that the Oilers can do that? To me, it is a possibility, but the Florida Panthers are going to make it very tough on them.
With where do you stand on McDavid's Conn Smythe candidacy, regardless of the outcome of any, like, regardless of the outcome of the series?
I love that you brought this up. In my opinion, the automatic awarding of the McDavid Conn Smythe would be if this goes seven games, regardless of outcome, and if McDavid is in the vicinity of the points record for Wayne Gretzky. What is that, 47? Yeah. I think he's at 38.
Yeah, 10 more
if
points.
If he sniffs that, 45, 44 even, if definitely if he ties it or exceeds it, I believe it is an automatic award. I don't care if the Florida Panthers win 10-0 in Game 7. If those criteria, what's the plural of criterium?
I think it's criteria is the plural.
Criteria, thank you. Much smarter than I.
Criterion, I believe, is the singular.
Okay, I appreciate that. I needed the assist. Great apple there. You're the Adam Oates to my Brett Hall. I appreciate
there we
that. If they are met, to me, it is a no-brainer automatic award to Connor McDavid, regardless of the Game 7 outcome. I think that's the level. Like, by the way, there are two players in history, and Connor McDavid is still on this pace, that have contributed either a goal or assist on at least half of his team's goals in the entire postseason for a team that has made the Stanley Cup final. The other guy wore number 99. So it's like he's already in historic territory here.
It's outrageous just how good he is and how consistently good he has been throughout these playoffs. And I think especially if it doesn't – I think if it ends tonight, it probably ends up going to somebody from Florida. I think if it goes beyond tonight, whether it's six or seven, then McDavid's going to have a really, really good chance to win it no matter what happens. Did the Bobrovsky getting chased end his candidacy in your eyes for the Conn Smythe?
If he doesn't have a good game the rest of the way – that's the problem. See, like, that's a good point. This is supposed to be a full playoffs award, right? Like, this is not NBA Finals MVP. This is, by definition, it's supposed to be every route. So Connor McDavid, well, Sergei Bobrovsky, to his credit, too, has been playing great. So, like, I get the recency bias. I get the final narrative perspective of it. But you can't ignore the contributions that McDavid has put forth this postseason for his team. You just can't. So does it hurt Bobrovsky's chances in particular? To me, that's one game, and he's had several amazing games. It shouldn't, but I do like the idea that you just put forth there that it goes six. Like, McDavid might have had enough body of work to exceed Bobrovsky's previous work, and quite frankly, Sasha Barkov, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think Barkov is still very much in the running as well, right? And, you know, you're right. It's such a funny thing because it is the full playoffs award, right? So you have to look at what they did in round one and what they did in round two. At the same time, when you have a bunch of guys with deserving cases, you know, if Barkov turns in a defensive clinic against McDavid tonight, right, and the Panthers are able to win, that could be that little extra boost at the end he needs to kind of clinch the victory.
Exactly. So I think for the recency narrative part of it, if Bobrovsky gets a shutout tonight, that's probably going to sway a lot of votes. If McDavid gets a hat trick in the next two games or like has another 4-point night and pushes it to seven, you know, that's going to also sway, right? Like it's almost as if we're neck and neck. And I mean, the betting lines are pretty close, right? Like we are in a situation where all three of them can really cement their case with outrageous games. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think what the betting lines really imply now is that it is a three-horse race, right? It's Bobrovsky, it's Barkov, it's McDavid, and that's about it in terms of the realistic contenders. Do you think that's right Are the markets onto it? Have the markets sniffed this out accurately, Arda?
I believe they have. I believe those are the three that you should be considering. And the way that they're ordered right now, with Bobrovsky as the slight favorite, then Barkov, then McDavid, that reflects the series, certainly, because if it ends tonight, McDavid is probably going to be edged out by whoever has maybe the better performance tonight, or maybe it will be full in consideration. Here's the other thing. If Sasha Barkov completely shuts out McDavid tonight, 0 points, zero shots, puts the clamps on him, we see clear defensive efforts where he's making it look easy against the best player in the world, that's gonna speak volumes too, right? So, mm-hmm. I know, you're right. Like, three-horse race can be very interesting. Like, it's going to come down to the wire for sure.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting to me, Arda, because that's the element that I actually have been surprised by in this series, is that it still feels like with McDavid and Bouchard, when they jump over the boards, even if it's head-to-head against Forsling and Barkov, the Panthers very rarely touch the puck. Like, even though it took until game four for the edge to count on the scoreboard, it still doesn't really feel to me like the Panthers have had an answer for 97.
Right. And if that, he needs to find the net, he needs to not just be out on the perimeter. Like, the perimeter possession, I think the Panthers are fine with. There have been parts of these games where the Oilers have had zero high danger chances in that home plate in front of the net. They have been, mm-hmm. at times, been struggling to get the puck towards the front of the net. But then you look at game four and you're like, that's the kind of effort. Forget about the scoreline even. It's just the effort. It's just the way that they were able to solve getting into those areas and everyone waking up. That game really felt to me like they were exercising a whole bunch of demons, right? All the storylines, all the narratives that were placed on the Edmonton Oilers leading into that game, it's almost like they were picking them apart one by one and crumpling them up and throwing them in the garbage.
Yeah, and, you know, there's been so much talk about the Oilers and their inability to get over the hump with McDavid and Draisaitl. And, you know, one of the things we've been asking a lot of our guests about, like, what's on the line in terms of the Oilers' legacy in this series. And with McDavid in particular, it's so fascinating, right? Because if they lose tonight, you know, it's going to be we had one guest say, like, hey, you'll still look back in a couple of years and they lost in five, and that's disappointing. But on the other hand, as you said, he's had such a good playoffs, right? He's breaking assist record held by Wayne Gretzky. It's going to be tough to pin this one on Connor McDavid in any way, shape, or form, even if the Oilers don't get it done or go out in game five tonight.
Yeah, this is not on McDavid at all. And I wouldn't be surprised, by the way. I know nothing. I'm just saying, like, there's been, you know, scuttlebutt that possibly, you know, he's not at 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the case, and we hear about something that he was dealing with this entire postseason or whatever the case may be, that'll make it even more spectacular that he was able to produce at that level. To me, and we all know this, okay? We all know this. And I was actually just talking about this, like, earlier. If the Oilers win the Stanley Cup this year, somehow, some way, they become the second team to pull off a reverse sweep, okay? Imagine that scenario. To me, Connor McDavid, that's when you start talking about him as an all-time great player, because everyone's waiting for him to win one Stanley Cup before we give that appointment to him, you know, before he becomes a statue guy in Edmonton, right? But, like, if he's able to do something that no other greatest of all-time player has done, a reverse sweep in the Stanley Cup final with that pressure cooker, having the postseason that he had, that's when we start saying, and by the way, he's performing like this where we have never seen pound for pound this level of talent in the NHL. And I'm not taking anything away from anyone previous, certainly not Wayne Gretzky. But what I'm saying is Connor McDavid is elite, and the chasm between him and the next best player is wide and large given the amount of talent that is in the league, the 700-plus players in the NHL, pound for pound. We've never seen this level of talent before. So But the thing is, we're all going to be waiting to have these conversations until he finally raises Lord Stanley's mug. That is the one thing that he absolutely needs to cement his legacy in hockey history.
Yeah, it is. He'll be on that level when it happens, but you're absolutely right. People are waiting for it to happen before we put him up there. You know, certainly with the Crosbys, and you go down the list of great players who have won the Stanley Cup. The one other guy I wanted to ask you about on the Panthers side, he hasn't really been a factor in this series, and that's Matthew Tkachuk. And of course, you know, he had such a star turn in the Stanley Cup playoffs last year. We all know how effective he can be. It's been a little surprising to see him not put more of his stamp on this series. Could that be a bit of an ace in the sleeve for the Panthers if he's able to kind of wake up a little bit tonight in Game 5?
Yeah, and the team has been doing so well without his contributions. I mean, last season we were talking about him being one of the greatest net front patient goal scorers that we've ever seen, right? Holding the puck the extra half a second or an extra second and a half in order to get the goaltender completely out of position to either tuck the backhand or roof the shot. You know, he's been terrific in that perimeter around the net. That was the big narrative leading into the Stanley Cup final with Matthew Tkachuk. And I still think that a lot of the things that he's contributing is off the ice for the team. He's probably the biggest character guy in the locker room. He's fantastic with the media. You know, we clamor to talk to people like him because he's so entertaining and, quite frankly, often insightful in his answers. So he's definitely a credit to the hockey world and to broadcasts, but also, I, to your point, he could absolutely show up at any moment and turn a game around, whether it's with his physicality, whether it's with his puck battles, or finding the back of the net. So the fact that he hasn't contributed to the level we know he can, a little surprising, but there's still those intangibles that he's contributing that I think make him an extremely valuable part of the team.
Arda, can't wait for Game 5 tonight. Thank you for doing this, and thank you for sharing the weatherman story as well. I did not know that. We're constantly learning new things about your professional history, Arda. It's a pleasure.
Buddy, Yale Town was a blast. If I didn't get a job in the States, I'd still be in Vancouver. That's how much I love the city.
There you go. We love to hear it. Thanks for doing this, Arda. Appreciate it.
Thanks, boys. Appreciate it.
That is Arda Okal from ESPN.
That's Arda from Yale Town.
Yeah,
Arda for the man on the street interview.
I can't believe the bosses at the Weather Network didn't like that. It's like that's the most attention people are paying to the Weather Network is when something like that happens.
It was incredible.
Dude, you know, this and you're fired?
You brought up a Ginlin in a snowstorm.
Yeah,
I happened to be working on a piece. And I was chatting with him the other day, and he was talking about how he'd make his backyard rink, even when he was in his playing days, right? He was talking about like getting home from road trips at like 1 a.m., like, you know, and going out and just like putting another layer on his ice sheet in the backyard. It's like, you were scoring 50 goals and winning the Maurice Richard. You're making ice after road trips. It's like the most hockey thing ever.
That's fantastic.
Unreal.
Yeah, so he's very comfortable in the winter weather, as he established. That line always kills me. And Jerome McGinley, like, such a nice, like, you know, low-key guy. He's like, yeah, you know, it's not a big deal. I'm Canadian. don't worry about it.
Yeah. Honestly, growing up as a Canucks fan during his, like, heyday was, like, pretty crummy. Because he was, like, the worst person to root against, right? Because he was so... Like, do you remember his... staged fight with Willie Mitchell in the season opener?
Yeah.
And it was like the most gentlemanly fight in NHL history, and it was like, how do you not like that guy? He's so cool.
And then he goes and he sets up Crosby on the golden goal. You know what I mean? It's like, what are we supposed to hang on to here?
No. See, I liked that because it was like, finally, a moment where I don't have to be conflicted.
But
you
can't cheer against him after that. You know what I mean? It's like, well, what, I'm going to be mad at this guy? Not that I was mad at him before, but it's like, now I really can't be mad at him.
See, this is also where, like, I felt really out of touch with Canucks fans in the playoffs, just in that I have so much admiration for how Dreisaitl and McDavid play. Mm. It feels to me like evolutionary Sedin stuff. Specifically the way that they crush it on retrievals, like how the skill game actually takes the back seat to the fact that they just win more 50-50 battles than anyone else. And it's just like, I love that. There's something that's so black and blue about their particular skill game that I really struggle to yeah, I struggle to understand when Canucks fans are like, McDavid, Draisaitl. I'm like, what are you talking about? These guys rock.
I don't
like,
know.
Absolutely rock.
I don't think there's a lot of distaste for those guys in particular. Maybe Draisaitl.
Oh, I see.
Maybe Draisaitl because of some of the personality stuff, and he's on the edge a little bit. He's not Canadian. But you do get to a point, and this is partly ties into the legacy stuff we were talking about with Arda, right? Like, he'll definitely be at that point if he wins the Cup, as much as Canucks fans will be upset that Edmonton has won the Cup. But you get to a point where you're just kind of like an unimpeachable part of a Canadian hockey legacy, right? Like Sidney Crosby got there. You go down the list, and McDavid is one cup away from being that. Like, I don't sense a lot of personal hatred towards Connor McDavid.
No, I there's some. I think there's two things that he doesn't have, because it's not just the cup. It's also that he's played in an era where best on best international hockey like just hasn't been seen.
That's true.
So he's never worn in a best-on-best tournament, like the Canadian jersey and delivered, like, gold at the Olympics or, like, had something like that. Because, you know, even more than the Cups, I think once Crosby became, you know, Hendrickson for our generation, right? I think that really changed it. It was, like, the best player on the biggest stage on home soil with Canada having not won gold in a decade. You know, that changed it. Like, that forever changed it. McDavid just hasn't had an opportunity to have that moment.
And you'd throw like a Joe Sakic at the Salt Lake City Games, right? Having that type of
for
moment.
Sure.
You know what I mean? You go down the list of Lemieux at the Canada Cup. Like, that is a part of the story for the all-time greats, how they end up in that, you know, it just being like universally loved, even by fans of rival teams.
100%. And McDavid's absolutely not there for Canucks fans. You see a lot of people talking about his diving or... I mean, I see people being like, I can't possibly root for Team Canada with McDavid on it. And it's just like, you'll feel differently when it,
as soon as he scores one awesome goal, you'll feel a lot differently.
That is on Twitter among some of the Canucks rabble that I follow. And I say rabble affectionately, I want to be clear, but yeah, it's just something I can't get on board with. Not for any reason other than that. If you marry that level of skill and ability with the ruggedness to win battles, to always come off the wall with the puck the way those two guys do, like, I'm very rarely going to not enjoy watching you play hockey. Like, that's just how it is.
We'll wrap it up there. Game 5 of the final is tonight. Panthers with another chance to close it out. You'll be able to hear it here on the station. We will be back tomorrow to break it all down and continue to look ahead to the Canucks off season. That's coming up on Canucks Talk tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.